Yes. Welcome to the Soulcast. Today we'll be doing another food autonomy episode. In this one, I have a very, very, very special guest, Stephen Barstow, the author of Around the World in 80 Plants. You know, as people who listen to this podcast know, every once in a while I'll do a podcast on, you know, permaculture, kind of food forestry sort of stuff. And Stephen's work is just incredible. He's been going around the world for, you know, a good portion of his life, documenting, cataloging, and testing various plants. I think in this interview he says he's, like, you know, grown over 8,000 plants. He's known, you know, on the internet as, like, the extreme salad man because he made a salad, I think, with either 8,000 or 2,000 ingredients or something ridiculous. And a lot of what he's growing are kind of perennial or mostly perennial vegetables that he's, again, just from collected from all around the world. Some of them are well-known ones like dandelion or hosta, like we talked about. And other ones are kind of more rare ones like, you know, victory onions or udo or, I mean, there's just so many. And in his book, Around the World in 80 Plants, not only does he, like, talk about, you know, how to grow these plants and what these plants are like, but he talks about the history of them, which is also very interesting. And what I loved about the book is it also tells you how to cook these things. So it's like a lot of these permaculture books that I've read, people talk about all these crazy plants and all this stuff that's so cool to grow because it comes back. But, you know, as Will Bonzel was saying in the last interview we did, like, not a lot of people, or it seems like a lot of people grow this stuff and talk about it, but aren't really, like, making a practice out of eating it. And so I asked Aaron from Edgewood Nursery to come down and conduct this interview with me because it was Aaron who introduced me to Stephen's work. And ironically, like, you know, I was up at Aaron's place the other day and I got to taste a lot of the these perennial vegetables like Turkish rocket and good King Henry and stinging nettle, and we had them all, like, steamed, and I was just, you know, just blown away by the richness of the flavor. And it, I really feel like, you know, if you eat vegetables, you know, your whole life, all we eat is, like, spinach and broccoli and tomatoes, and it's really boring. You know, as a vegetarian, you know, I want to eat different things. I want to, you know, open it up. And so another thing Stephen talks about in this interview is the sort of health benefits and you know, the so-called Mediterranean diet, and how people who eat a wide variety of different vegetables tend to live longer, and, like, the talks about the studies based on that. And there's, you know, a lot of interesting stuff coming out on this subject about you know, growing perennial vegetables and the health benefits of it. And Aaron talked about it a little bit in the interview we did back. So yeah, check out Stephen's blog, Edimentals, at edimentals.com. Pick up his book, Around the World in 80 Plants. And yeah, and if you're interested in permaculture and food forestry stuff, his book is an excellent companion. Even if not, even if you're just growing in raised beds, like I'm growing a lot of this stuff just in raised beds, you know, just because these things grow plentifully and they come back every year, bigger and better and badder, iller. And yeah, and I'll just give a little plug to Aaron, who came down. If you've listened to my other podcast episodes with Aaron about tree care and perennial vegetables, he sells a lot of these seeds, and I've been trying to grow a lot of this stuff for years, and I never got it to grow until I got it from Aaron's nursery. So if you want to try out some of these plants, check out edgewoodnursery.com, and you can order some of these plants. And yeah, and you can follow Stephen on Twitter. And this is an awesome interview. It's a great conversation. I say it a lot, but this conversation could have, it should have gone on for at least, like, I could have done more with it, but we ran out of time. The last thing I'll say is this conversation begins abruptly because Aaron and Steven were talking about the origins of Hablitzia, aka Caucasian mountain spinach, just before the interview started, and what they were saying was really interesting about whether or not it really did come from the Caucasus Mountains, and it seems that's the case. So yeah, it starts with that, and then we'll go more formally into the interview. And before we get started, as usual, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network. And if you want to support this podcast on Patreon, check it out, patreon.com/SOLEONE. And yeah, let's get into this.
Where did you get this?
Your friendly neighborhood anarchist.
More of an anarchist militant.
People involved in social struggles than everybody else.
People have been waiting for some content.
Radio. One show.
The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Percy Goodness.
The Final Straw Radio.
noblogs.org. If you're listening,
yeah, I love the stories behind the plants. The stories are almost as interesting for me as the taste or the plants themselves.
Yeah, I would love to see some evidence of traditional use in the Caucasus, but yeah, it hasn't turned up yet.
No, as you know, there've been two expeditions to insert of the elusive Hablitzia in the Caucasus. First of all, Justin West. Did you know him?
I've corresponded with him a tiny bit.
Yeah, he kind of disappeared a bit off the. He was living in the Netherlands with a lady called Leanne Fogg, and they had a trip to the Caucasus looking for it, and it was a lot of effort, I think, and they found me. And they finally found it after a lot of effort, and they reported their findings, I think, in one of these permaculture magazines over there, permaculture something or other, not magazine, but Permaculture Solutions, I think it's called. So that was back a few years ago now, probably 7-8 years ago. And then there was another American guy in Denmark.
Yeah,
Tycho. Yeah, you know him, Tycho Holcomb, I think his real name is.
Yeah.
So he and Carolina went to the Caucasus and found it on the outside of a cave, which was really cool, which could suggest it was a limestone cave, which could suggest that it needs lime. So if anybody's struggling with growing it, then it's a good idea to add lime to the soil. But interesting, I originally got my first wild accession came from a botanist in Georgia on the Russian side of the Caucasus. And he collected seed for me. This was, it must be about 13, 14 years ago now. And and I remember him telling me that he had found the plant growing in near to a cave. And this was a totally different part of the Caucasus. So... I just can't find the information. It was in an email, but I seem to have lost that email, so I can't double check my memory.
Yeah. Have you seen Tycho's book on permaculture?
Yes, I've got a copy.
Because there were some really interesting pictures in there of the cave near where they found the Hablitzia and all the the petroglyphs inside the cave, and it made me wonder if potentially the association between Hablitzia and cave mouths could be to some degree anthropogenic. So if it was a food plant for people using those caves for whatever, that could be a vector for moving seeds, but that's just a wild theory.
Yeah, that's interesting. No, I haven't heard that one before, and I must admit I haven't really read the book in detail. I'm not very good at reading books. Actually the first picture this Russian botanist sent me from the Caucasus was, and I think I've got a picture in my book, is a picture of Hibiritsu just climbing up into a maple tree. It just looks as though it's a kind of a typical forest habitat, nothing unusual, no caves or anything like that. But I must try and contact that guy again. I actually saw him not too long ago. He turned up on Facebook. So there's an opportunity there to ask a few more questions, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. I mean, it's funny because you think about the, you know, white people crawling out of the caves of the Caucasus Mountains and, you know, spinach being wild on the outside of their caves is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they searched everywhere in the forest, I think, and just, this was their last, you know, they've been searching for ages, and finally it turned up in a place they hadn't really expected to find it.
That's amazing. You know, usually we start the podcast off with like a lot of like small talk, and then I press record, but the small talk was Hibiritsu today. So yes. No one's mad about that. Let's just start the interview. I mean, I guess we kind of have already started, but let's formally start the interview if that's okay with everyone. So, So Stephen Barstow, is it Stephen or Stefan?
Stephen.
Okay. Stephen Barstow, welcome to the Soulcast. Thank you for agreeing to come on. We got Aaron Parker from Edgewood Nursery, who had introduced me to your book. And so Aaron was kind enough to drive down here to sit in on the interview and, you know, help ask questions and just make this a more, you know, interesting conversation. So, Aaron, thank you for coming down.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've certainly enjoyed my previous times on the Soulcast and glad to be here again.
So, Stephen, how you living?
Yeah,
How's it going?
Thanks for having me too. What?
How you doing? How's your day going?
Oh, the day. We've got absolutely wonderful weather here, you know. Clear blue skies, and I'm sat here at my desk looking out over the fjords. I've been out in the garden working a bit, tidying up my little bit of forest and cutting up wood and things like that, and been sowing seed and transplanting, and exciting times.
Thank God. It's my first winter in Maine, and thank God it's almost over. I'm ready for
You've still got snow, haven't you?
Yeah, we've had snow since November 10th, and we just
I've heard. Yeah,
we just got like 4 more inches 2 days ago. It's been a very long winter, but it's verging on 50 degrees Fahrenheit here, and looks like it's not going to drop below freezing for the foreseeable future.
Well, that's good. Yeah, so things are looking up there as well.
Yeah, I mean,
It's been a strange winter here too. Actually, I've been able to, you know, we're at 63.5 degrees north, which some people think of as being the Arctic. But it's because we've got the fjord. It's one of the biggest or volume-wise fjords in Norway. And the water doesn't go below 6 degrees centigrade in the winter. So the fjord represents warmth in the winter and cold in the summer, actually. So it keeps our summer temperatures down, but and the winter temperatures up, and added to the kind of general North Atlantic drift or Gulf Stream, then our winters are relatively mild. But this winter has been very strange, in that I've been able to dig the garden the whole winter. We have had a few cold periods, but whenever it's been cold, there's been deep snow, which has insulated the soil. So there's been more or less no time in the whole of the winter when I've not been able to go out and dig, which is, I look forward to the winter because the time I don't have to do any gardening.
Well, that sounds kind of terrifying that the ground isn't freezing at 60 degrees north.
Yeah, I know. But we're getting, you know, these huge, I think in this part of the world, we're getting the biggest changes. And it's more the variability which is changing. So just 5 winters ago, we had 3 months solid freeze, and my gardens, I don't have much soil. I have about 20 centimeters of soil maximum anywhere in the garden. So it's and it freezes right down to the rock. And that winter we had, you know, getting on for 4 months of freeze, the whole garden and soil frozen solid for 3 months. So and then this winter there's no frost at all in the soil. So it's huge changes from year to year.
Well, we'll happily trade with you. We'll, if you want, you can take the barren frozen wastes and we'll take the fjords.
Yeah, okay. No, thanks.
It's so funny. Anytime I hear the word fjords, I think of that book, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Do you know this book?
Yeah. Yeah, I know it. Yeah.
Well, so just just to kind of, you know, for introductory reasons, let's talk about how you came to this work, how you, like, you know, developed this passion for, you know, crazy salad greens and perennial vegetables. What brought you to this work?
Well, I'm basically a sick man. I have collectomania. Have you heard of this? My dad, he collected stamps, or he still does collect stamps. He's 94 now. And I had to find something to collect, and it became edible plants. really what started it all off was that I, you know, I grew up in the UK. I'm still British. I moved to Norway in 1981 to work. And so that was 38 years ago now. And I was a vegetarian. At that time, vegetarianism was quite common in the UK. There were over 1 million vegetarians. In Norway, there were literally 5 or 6 vegetarians, and they didn't dare admit they were vegetarian either, so I didn't discover them for many years. So really to survive as a vet, and the supermarkets were really empty of anything. You couldn't get whole foods, you couldn't get vegetables. And so to survive as a vegetarian, I had to start growing my own. Luckily, I had a lot of land, the place we were renting to start with, and so I just started digging and planting stuff. At the same time, people said the reason Norwegians ate very little greens, and probably the Norwegians are the race in the world that eat the least vegetables. I mean, talking about leafy greens and things like that. Was the fact it was so cold here. That's what I was told anyway, in particular the summers, which are relatively cool. I think the average temperature here is about 14, 15 degrees centigrade in summer. Maximum goes up to about 29, but that is very unusual. So our summers are cool. And so people told me it was too cool to grow vegetables. And I guess what I've done over the last 35, 36 years is that I've disproved that theory. Today, I believe that where I'm living is one of the best places to grow vegetables. But it's not the common vegetables which grow best in this area, is the perennials. When I say it's one of the best places to grow vegetables, I'm thinking that actually we never have drought here. You know, it's never too warm. Even though it's too cold to grow things like tomatoes and cucumbers and things like that outside, it's absolutely ideal for growing a lot of the leafy green perennial vegetables. And it's also a very good area to grow fruit, actually. Things like apples and cherries and pears, currants, they all grow extremely well here. My parents, they live in the south of England, and every other year they have a complete crop failure of plums, for example, because of late frosts. We never get late frosts up here. So when the apple trees and all the fruit trees are in flower, there's no risk at all of frost. And that has to do with the fact that I live so far north that we don't have any nighttime by May. Okay? We're almost getting there. And when there's no nighttime, the temperature doesn't drop. Okay? So we don't get frosts. Added to the fact we have the fjord nearby, which keeps the average temperature up. So we're in kind of a perfect environment for both growing perennials, which are, and if you think about it, most perennials come from, they grow naturally in forests, because most of the temperate world was covered with forest originally. And they're adapted to growing most in the early spring before the leaves start leafing out and blocking out the sunlight. So most of the perennials that I grow are actually woodland plants, which grow very well in cool spring weather. So, and in fact, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, we had the coldest spring ever here. And right up until the middle of June, so 20th of June or something like that, we didn't have a single day when the temperature went above 68 Fahrenheit. And the traditional farmers were complaining about and saying that, well, this is going to be a catastrophic year if we don't have any warmth soon, because we can't get out into the land to start ploughing and planting. At the same time, I experienced record yields in my garden, where I'm growing mostly perennial plants, because of exactly this thing that, in particular, leafy green vegetables grow best in the early spring when it's cool. And we had actually from the beginning of April until middle of June, we didn't have any frosts, and at the same time the temperature was below 68 Fahrenheit. It was too cold for the flowers to start appearing, so it was perfect conditions for leaves to grow, but not flowers. So it's which tells me that this is yet another reason for growing perennials. They're much more robust against climate change and large swings in the climate.
Well, if you believe in climate change.
If you do, indeed.
No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question. Like, do you think it works in reverse, that when it's, you know, when it's really warm, like that, these perennials kick in as well?
Sorry, what do you mean? It's very warm?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, so you're talking about in cold summers, your perennials are doing much better. But do you think it also, you know, has the same effect in reverse? Like when it's really warmer, do you see the benefit of perennials?
Well, I think they're in general more robust against large changes in temperature and drought, and because they have an extensive root system which is already developed in the springtime, and so they can drought, for example. I mean, it's if you don't have access to water, it's much more sense to grow perennials, because they have a much more extensive root system. The same applies to grains, of course, as well. And the roots go very, very deep and are able to access water, which isn't available to annual crops. So both that and the fact that perennials need less fertilizer for the same reason. Of course, they're much less... They need much less energy as well, in that we plant them one time, and it's kind of a bit like the ultimate no-dig gardening.
That's awesome.
So you plant one time, and then they come back year after year without us having to use a lot of energy, both digging or plowing or whatever.
That's amazing. I mean, what's cool is that when you started doing this in the 80s, permaculture, I don't think was as big as it is today. And so I'm curious, as we're talking about perennials and why they're great, and how the crops you're growing are mostly woodland crops. But I guess, could you talk about as far as woodland crops and greens, what are some examples of them, and how did you go about discovering them and finding them? Because it's it's a whole cuisine you've essentially had to invent for yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was a very long process. It wasn't something that just came overnight. One of the big things for me was that having moved here and discovered a country with hardly any vegetables in the supermarket, the first spring I was here, I discovered, or somebody told me, that in Norway they have a national foraging organization, which literally translates as the Useful Plant Society. And it's a very old society here. It goes back 100 years. And as far as I've been studying these things in many countries over many years now. As far as I can find out, Norway, this is the only national foraging organization anywhere. So in this country with very few vegetables in the supermarket, we have this national foraging organization. And a local group of this national organization was established in the same year that I moved here to the city of Trondheim, which is quite near to where I live. I heard about this group and I joined them. And I think it was in the second spring I was here, I went out on a spring forage with them to look at wild edible plants. And I very quickly learned that there was something like 60 wild edible plants just growing in the local area, mainly along the shoreline, where there's this very large diversity of plants. That was a real eye-opener for me, of course. And many of those plants not all of them were good. Some of them were what I call the emergency food category. You would only eat them if you were really desperate, but there were some really good ones as well. And we had two kids, and after some, I didn't have so much time to go out foraging to get the food, which is quite an effort. I mean, it's not that far away, but it's a kilometer there and back. And I thought, well, I could actually start growing these in my garden instead. I had a pretty big garden by that time. So I started moving things like caraway. Do you know caraway? Nettles and things like that into my garden and tried to grow them. And I was totally unaware at the time, but this is what people have always done traditionally. They've moved their favorite wild edibles into their gardens to be close to the kitchen. It was more practical to grow them than foraging them, and in the process they would of course select the best looking specimens and as the first stage of domestication. So I basically was inspired to start with by the local foraging traditions. Now I was working the main reason I moved here was to work. I was trained as an oceanographer. So I've worked until I took early retirement in spring 2017. I worked as a climatologist for ocean waves. So I worked, for example, for many years on ocean wave energy, renewable energy from the ocean waves. And as part of my job, I had to travel a lot to conferences, and we actually had a very big project in the South Pacific from the late 1980s to the early 1990s, where we were assessing how much energy there was in the South Pacific Islands that were using diesel as their main fuel at that time. And that entailed me going down to places like Fiji and the Cook Islands and places like this to do courses on ocean wave energy. And as I and normally when I travel half right the way around the world, I try to take a bit of holiday around this, and I stopped in various places along the way, like New Zealand and the west coast of the US and places like this. And I started buying books on foraging in other parts of the world. And I remember I was in Seattle one year, and I found a book called Sturt Avant's Edible Plants of the World. I don't know if you know that one, Aaron.
I'm not familiar with that one. I think the book that I've picked up on your recommendation is Cornucopia 2.
Yeah, that came out a bit later. The first one I mentioned, Sturt Avant's Edible Plants of the World, was actually published in 1920. And it was put together by an American professor who basically spent his whole life documenting the world's edible plants. And it was published after he died in 1920. And I found this book in a bookstore in Seattle. And, well, this looks interesting. And I took it home and basically crammed full of information of about 3,000 of the world's edible plants. And no pictures, it wasn't an identification guide. It just gave information, a botanical name, and information about how that plant was used. And to my surprise, many of the plants which were mentioned as edible plants, I was actually already growing in my own garden as ornamentals, because I'd inherited an ornamental garden. So were a lot of perennials, things like hosta and daylily. And I think you already mentioned hosta in one of your earlier interviews, haven't you, Aaron?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think that was one. I was listening in on that the other day. And, wow, so suddenly I had a garden which was actually full of food, and which I hadn't been aware of before. I thought, this is cool. I remember another one when I first looked in this book was the North American nodding onion, Allium cernium. You know this one?
Yep.
It's the most widespread allium or onion species in North America, and was a very important food plant for the Native Americans and also for the Europeans when they first arrived in North America. It was real survival food at that time. And I remember the story in the book about it was a group of French who were traveling to what is today Chicago. And the story is that one of the most important foods that they ate on this very long journey to the area around Chicago was Allium cernium. And it's kind of a minor ornamental also. It's a rather beautiful plant. It's totally hardy. And because it's very widespread in North America, there are many different forms that have cropped up. There are different color forms. There is white, and the normal color is pinkish color. There are large kind of giant varieties, and there are miniature varieties. And it's extremely drought resistant as well, extremely hardy, and also very tasty. And it's one of the few plants that I can actually eat in winter, because it stays green all winter, even though it's maybe minus 20, minus 30 centigrade, it can withstand that. So certainly these books and later on another trip, the book that you mentioned, Aaron, Cornucopia 2, A Source Book of Edible Plants, which is also put together by an American professor, called Stephen Fatiola in California. That really is probably the book that I've used most, because there are a lot of mistakes in the old book by Sturtevant in 1920. Is not totally reliable. Cornucopia 2 is a much better modern-day updated version of this, which is available. Again, with about 3,000 of the world's edible plants. And there are probably I estimate there are probably something like 100,000 edible plants in the world. And most of us who eat supermarket foods probably never eat more than about 30 in our lifetimes. So, and with this collectomanic thing I have, I basically just started, reading through this book, and well, that looks cool. I must try that, and I'll try that. And over the last 30 odd years, and I'm pretty. I've made records of what I've planted over many years, and I have a list of something like 8,000 different edible plants that I've actually planted over that time. Of course, not all have survived, and probably only about a quarter of them are in my gardens today. But in the process, you know, a lot of them have turned out not to be hardy enough for my climate. Others have proved to be surprisingly hardy. So there have been some winners and losers, and some really, really good ones. A huge diversity, which has allowed me to make these multi-species dishes, which I've become known as. They call me the extreme salad man, because in 2003, 16 years ago now, I made a salad with 538 ingredients. I've also made a pesto. I made a pesto once with 212 different types of onion. And I've also made a ferment with 412 different different plants. So, why do it? Well, actually, these multi-species dishes were inspired by what's become known as the Mediterranean diet. I'm sure you've heard of. Some 20 years ago, they discovered that old folks in mountain villages in places like Italy and Greece had a very low levels of cardiovascular disease. And on the back of that, they various botanists or ethnobotanists got money to find out what the hell these people have been eating to make themselves so so healthy. And one of the my interpretation of the results from this is it was actually one of the most important components was diversity, that they ate a large diversity of, in particular, leafy green vegetables. And in addition, well, just over the last 20 years, they've discovered over 3,000, probably nearer 4,000 edible plants that were used traditionally in the Mediterranean countries. And when you see that Cornucopia 2 has only 3,000, you can see it's only a very small part of the world's edible flora. And in addition to that, not only was there this huge diversity of plants that were used, and they also discovered a number of multi-species dishes which were eaten mainly in the springtime, when they'd go out into the countryside and they would pick everything they could find. And typically it could be something between 50 and 60. There are many examples of dishes with over 50 different plants. There were salads, there were soups, there was a calzone, which I have the recipe of in my book, It has 51 species of plants in it. It took me 6 years to make because first I had to grow those 51 species to be available at the same time. So these multi-species dishes were a big inspiration, but at the same time, they gave a kind of a message to me that if you want to live healthily, then diversity is in many ways more important than eating a lot of greens, if you see what I mean.
Well, I would definitely agree with that. And I just wanted to ask you a couple questions about your current garden before I forget them. Mm. So one is, how do you keep track of what's what? I know your place is fairly small, so I imagine everything's quite crowded together. And it sounds like you, at any given time, have multiple thousands of species growing there.
Yeah. Well, I've had to be pretty systematic about this, and I have a big Excel sheet basically with basically a list of all the plants, and I've divided the garden up into different beds or different parts of the garden. There's something like 30 different beds or areas of the garden, and when I plant something, I basically, during the summer when I'm planting, I just write it down on paper and try and describe. I don't really make a map or anything, but I say, well, this plant I planted just to the west of another plant, which has been there for a long time, so I know more or less where it is. And that then goes on to this Excel sheet in the winter months, and I've got a bit more time to register. I have this... So I have all the information electronically, at least, the problem is knowing what has died. I mean, things disappear, and it's an active thing, planting, but dying is something you might not notice. So it's much easier keeping track of what you plant than what you're losing. So I haven't managed to do that, because I've just got too many plants. So when I say I have 2,000 plants in the garden, it's a very rough estimate. I know I've planted 8,000 to 9,000 over the years, but how many survive is difficult to estimate.
A follow-up question would be with 2,000 species in a fairly small plot, that I assume means there's only a very small amount of any given species, but are there any that you enjoy eating so much that you've given them extra space? And I'd be curious to know which ones you think warrant a larger footprint.
Yeah, there are a few, like hosta we've already talked about. Which surprises a lot of people. Surprises a lot of people. Hosta being actually one of the world's most commonly grown ornamental plants should be edible. And I kind of discovered this and wrote about it. I think I was the first to write about it in the West, although it's a plant which has traditionally been used in Japan, Korea, and partly in China. For a long time, it's probably one of the most productive perennial vegetables. At the same time, it can grow in almost it doesn't need any direct sunlight, so it's a real woodland plant. My biggest plants are on the north side of the house, which hardly get any sunlight at all. And if you're familiar with growing a hosta. And there are actually 10,000 different cultivars of hosta in the world. And there's a big North American Hosta Society, for example, devoted to growing hosta as ornamentals. So we were talking about hosta, and there are something like 10,000 cultivars of hosta in the world, and you have. The North American, I think it's called the North American Hosta Society over there, which has as many members devoted to growing hostas as ornamentals. And they were, they helped me a lot because, I'm a bit careful. You might think I'm not very, that I eat so many greens, but I'm always researched properly and before I start eating, particularly plants that I know nobody else has eaten in my area. And one of those was hosta. I'd read that it was edible and that it was cultivated for markets in Japan, but I did see a few comments about it being bitter tasting and a bit unpleasant. I think Ken Fern's Plants for a Future database mentions this. So I was a bit unsure whether to try it or not. And then I read on the website of the North American Hosta Society, they had an annual meeting. And it turned out that particular year, and they had a kind of an annual dinner, that one of the members actually knew about eating hostas. And the members were then served up various dishes with hosta greens. And there were things like hosta capita, which is like a spanner capita is a spinach pie. But instead of using the spinach, they used hosta leaves. And after the event, the members were able to comment about their experiences at this annual meeting on their website. And I happened to see this, and the comments about the food that they'd eaten with hosta were all really positive. They were all very surprised that what for them was an ornamental plant was so tasty. So I finally took the plunge, and I actually made one of these spinach pies using hosta leaves instead and served it to my family. There was not a hint of bitterness. And we all enjoyed it. And we also discovered that nutritionally, hosta is probably better than any of the leafy green vegetables you can buy in the supermarket. It really shows if you grow some of the larger hostas, you can see that it's a productive plant as well. It's almost impossible to kill them. They come back year after year. Even those slugs can cause problems in some gardens. They come back year after year. They're very robust. They don't need any direct sunlight, so they could go on the north side of your house. They tolerate more or less everything from drought to warmth in the summer and very cold summers as well. So they're a very adaptable plant. That's why it's become such a common ornamental around the world. And then three or four years ago, I was invited by a Danish nursery to join them on a trip to Japan. And I accepted, and they had Japanese nursery contacts who had agreed to show us around some of the. You see, in Japan, they have something called supermarkets have a department which is devoted to what was previously foraged food. It's called Sansai, meaning mountain vegetables. And because the mountain villages are becoming depopulated, people are just moving into the cities, the cities are getting bigger and bigger, there's this demand for this, what was previously wild food, these good tastes of the countryside, you know. And one of those plants was hosta, previously foraged, but nowadays actually cultivated in farms around the big cities. So I was invited on this trip to Japan, and right enough, and this was early, it was about this time of year, early April, all the supermarkets were selling hosta shoots. We went to restaurants where they were serving serving hosta. We went to they were actually using it as the blanched shoots, so they force the roots of hosta in darkened greenhouses, which and because it's dark, the young shoots are blanched to a white color. In Japanese, literally translated, they call them hosta icicles, and they're used as a salad. So they basically dip these shoots into kind of a soy sauce mix. And yeah, they're delicious. They're crispy and slightly sweet tasting, not at all bitter, which was reported by, has been reported by other authors in the past. So I wrote about, based on these experiences, I wrote about hosta in Permaculture magazine in the UK. I think it was the first article about hosta for food. They called it the Oriental Spinach, the article. Yeah, so that's one of my favorites that I, you know, if somebody, if you came to me and said, well, which one, if which perennial vegetables would you grow in your garden if you were to start again today and you wanted to concentrate on the maximum yield, then definitely hosta would be on the top of that list, and I would grow a lot of hosta. And you can also cut it and it comes again. You can take all the young shoots and it will still flower in the same year. So you can still get the ornamental part of the hosta, which are grown mainly for the leaves, but also for the flowers. So this combination of food and of ornamental is a particular love of mine. I particularly like plants that look good in this year, so they taste good. And these I call edimentals, or edible ornamentals, which is also my website, edimentals.com.
That's awesome. It's so funny because after I did the interview with Aaron, I was like telling my wife about hostas and she just refuses to eat them. And I'm like, you know what? Cause she just hates them. Like just doesn't like them looking at them. And I was like, you're going to like this spring, like you're going to think you're just eating some regular stir fry, but it's going to have cattails and hostas in it. And I'm not going to tell you till after. And that's just be pissed at me now because it's going to happen. So sorry.
Fantastic. Well, that's this spring coming, is it?
Yeah, it's coming right around the corner. Yeah. I might get in trouble because she's pregnant, but hey, you know what? Some risks are worth it.
Well, good luck.
Well, what are some of your other favorite plants to grow?
Well, I mean, it's good when you're growing perennials that you have you have plants which are yielding at different times as well. I mean, most perennials are spring tasting, spring harvested, but some are really early and some are quite late at appearing in the spring. Hosta is one of the late appearing perennials in my garden. I don't know if it's the same over there, but usually in my garden, hosta is kind of late, second part of May harvest, I would say. Whereas at the moment, one of the best at the moment is Hablitzia, which we've already talked about. Did you want me to say any more about that now, or you've already got enough about that?
Yeah, I think we got enough. I recorded everything, most of what you said about Hablitzia.
Yep.
So I was like, I'm not going to lose this. I need to record this. So, yeah.
Yeah. So Hablitzia is one of the best very early spring edibles. So I can harvest that some years, like this year, I've been harvesting it since January in small amounts. But beginning of April, it really starts to grow. So at the moment, I'm eating a lot of Hablitzia, practically every dinner, and both cooked and as a salad plant. Other ones, early spring, well, there are many different onions, which some of which stay green all winter. Like I've already mentioned, the nodding onion, the North American one. This week I've eaten Allium victorialis. I think we call it victory onion in English. could tell you something about that. It has an interesting, it's an onion which has a very wide geographic distribution. In the wild, it grows all the way from the Pyrenees in southern Europe through the Alps. It grows in the Caucasus. It grows in Siberia and also in Japan, where it's one of the favorite wild edibles of the Ainu people in northern Japan. And it even grows in the Aleutian Islands. So it's a very hardy plant. In the Alps and Pyrenees, it grows above the tree line. In Siberia, it grows as a forest plant. But we also have it in, it's a very wide-leaved onion. It's a bit like ramps that you have over there, Allium trichocum, or the European, what we call ramsons, very similar name, which is Allium ursinum. But Victory onion is a somewhat bigger onion than both of those. And you could grow it in both open conditions and in shady conditions. It likes, along with, I think, ramps and the European one ramps, to have fairly damp soil, particularly in the first part of the summer. So it's a kind of a damp woodland plant, or a damp, so it grows also in alpine meadows. It's probably about twice as big as what I've seen ramps can grow to. And it's a much more compact plant, and it grows quicker, I think. And we have one population in actually in Norway. It's not a wild plant here, but it's naturalized in a big way in the past in the Lofoten Islands, which is a picturesque island group off the above the Arctic Circle in Norway. And it's escaped in a big way there. We don't know how it was introduced, but one of the theories is that this was one of the plants that the Vikings introduced to the Lofoten Islands because it was a very important Viking settlement there. And they traveled widely and they brought plants back to Norway with them. And we know that they grew onions, but we don't know which onions they grew. Probably they grew a number of different species. So within Norway, this has become quite a commonly grown perennial onion, and I have quite a few different accessions in my garden from different parts of the world. And some of them, the different. So I have plants from both in Japan, from the Alps, from the Norwegian population, and I've been comparing them. And I see that there are very big differences in how early they start coming. The Japanese ones are currently getting up for, they're probably about 20, 30 centimeters high, getting on for a foot high. And other ones, the Norwegian populations are actually still not even visible, hardly. So even within the one species, you can get a big variation in the time of harvest.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know where the name came from?
Victorialis?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't actually know that. Yeah. Victorialis, I'm not totally sure. It probably means something in Latin or Greek rather than Victory. No, I don't know that. No, sorry.
That's okay.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, it seems like there's a good story there somewhere.
What about Udo? That of that was one of the plants in your book that I thought looked the most interesting. And I tracked down some seeds. I got them, stratifying in the fridge. But if you could talk about Udo a little bit, that would be awesome.
Yeah, Udo is, it really is one of my absolute favorites, and probably the plant that impresses people most when they come to my garden. And it's my largest vegetable as well. It can grow to, you know, about 3 meters during the summer months. It's a herbaceous perennial, so it dies completely back to the ground every autumn. And my oldest plant is 17 years now. I harvest maybe a third of the shoots every year. Possibly you could harvest a bit more. I just have too much food in the springtime, so I don't get around to harvesting everything. But Udo is in the ginseng family, Aralia cordata in Latin. I came across it actually in one of the first books about Asiatic vegetables, which was written by an English woman, Joy Larkham. The book that came out in the 1970s, and it talks quite briefly about this plant, Aralia cordata Udo, as being an important edible in the Far East. But it took me a long time to get hold of seed, and it probably took 3 or 4 years from seed to be able to start harvesting it regularly. And one of the things I read was that there was a very peculiar, very strange cultivation method for Udo in the Far East. But first, let me just tell you the part that you eat is the shoots in the springtime. The shoots, they harvest them up to about 1 meter tall. Each individual shoot, and there's probably about 40 shoots on my largest Udo. So 40 shoots, which are about 2 foot high, something like that. You still use feet over there, don't you?
Yeah.
So 2 feet high and probably about an inch in diameter. So quite a lot of volume in each shoot.
Yeah, that's a substantial shoot.
Sorry?
That's a substantial shoot.
Yeah. And they have two forms of Udo. They have the green Udo and the white Udo. White is blanched. And blanching you can do in your own garden quite simply by having a really big bucket over it, or you can heap something over the plant in the early spring, like leaves or whatever. The white Udo is milder tasting. The green one can be a bit strong tasting to some palates. But in Japan, they use both. The green Udo, for example, they use with tempura. You know what tempura is?
Yeah.
It's these vegetables which are stir-fried in batter, yeah? Which is kind of important street food in the Far East. And they have tempura restaurants there, and you can... Normally they would use foods which are a bitter or stronger tasting in tempura, because the oil, when it's deep fried in oil, basically coats your tongue, so you don't perceive the bitter tastes as strongly as you would otherwise. So in order to detect the taste of the plant, they should be stronger tasting. Another one would be dandelion, for example, which we can come back to later if you like. The green Udo would normally be cooked in that way. The white Udo could be used as a salad crop. And the first time I used it, I basically took a few of these shoots and just cut the shoots into small segments. First of all, you peel the outside layer of the shoot, which is a bit fibrous, and then just dice the shoots, and then you just have a simple salad dressing. In the Far East, they would use soy sauce, soy sauce with, for example, roasted sesame seeds and sesame oils, for example. To be a simple salad that you can harvest in the garden and have ready within about 15 minutes, what I call fast, slow food. So that's the... But you can also use it in all sorts of different dishes. It's also fermented in the Far East. Back to this unusual method of cultivation, I read somewhere that in Western Tokyo, they have a very unusual way of blanching the udon. They've dug these subterranean caverns under the city in a very special type of soil, which they can basically dig out underground and make these caverns without it collapsing, without any support or anything. And when I knew I was going on this study trip to Japan 4 years ago, this was one of the top of my list to experience. And but it turned out not to be that simple to get in touch with the people involved or to get permission. But luckily, in the end, I had a Facebook friend in the Netherlands who was from Japan, who called the city clerk in Western Tokyo for me and managed to get permission for us to visit one of the farms. The farmer himself said he would only allow us to come if we had an interpreter with us. So we had to provide an interpreter. Another Facebook friend, a Japanese friend in Norway, knew somebody who lived in the mountains of Japan, who had grown up in the US. And she agreed to come down to Tokyo and act as interpreter for us. So we had a fantastic day on this farm, and according to the farmer, we were the first Europeans to ask to experience this. But it was just amazing, and the actual underground caverns were in a young woodland. It was almost like you can imagine having a forest garden. You know about forest gardening. You have different layers in a forest garden, and this was an underground layer underneath everything else, where they were forcing the udo. So basically, they take the large roots of this huge herbaceous perennial, and they move them down into this these subterranean caverns, plant them in soil, and they then grow in the complete darkness over a period of a few weeks. They harvest them, and then they move the root back onto into the sunlight again and grow it on for another period. And this particular way of blanching udo gave the highest quality because the temperature of these underground caverns was constant. They told me it was around 17, 18 degrees centigrade. This was early April.
That's amazing. What
but we also saw udo being blanched in overground caverns, overground huts, you know, with where the light was eliminated. But in these, the temperature varies a lot more, and so it gave us slightly less money. And then we also saw it growing on outside on farmland, heaped with rice husks. So when they polished the rice, they had this spoil left, which they were using to heap over the roots of udo in the springtime. So that was really fascinating to experience, and I've written about this on my blog.
What does it? I mean,
because it came after my book came out in 2014.
What does it taste like? Does it taste comparable to asparagus, or like what would you compare it to flavor wise?
It's pretty unique, I would say. It has I wouldn't exactly call it sweet, but No, it's Udo. You'll have to try it.
Nice.
I can't explain the taste, but it's not bitter, nor is the green Udo. It's not. I wouldn't describe it as bitter. To some people, it's a slightly unpleasant taste, and when it's blanched, it's kind of a very much milder version of that, which I find pleasant. But you'll have to try it and see.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't wait to try it.
Have you tried it?
I have not.
Aaron?
Some seedling plants that I grew, and they never really got established, and then they were eaten by voles, which is a big problem for me, as I have a very high population of voles. So occasionally I lose stuff, but it seems especially things that have large, delicious roots like Udo or Codenopsis I've had a hard time keeping around. So I've got some ideas of how I'm going to try and protect those type of plants, but it's still some of them are still kind of in the experimentation phase.
Yeah, well, I'm lucky that I'm living on a rock, basically, and voles can't really get down very deep enough, so they don't like it here.
Yeah, nice.
That's awesome. One of the coolest things about your book is that, you know, you go into like the, you know, whatever history you can uncover in stories about these plants. Cause you know, when we go to grocery stores, we don't think about, you know, how broccoli came to exist or whatever. And so when we're learning about all these plants in your book, like you get this awesome history, but then on top of it, you know, how to cook these plants, you know, clearly you like us, you love, you know, to eat. And, so it's like, you know, part cookbook, part, you know, gardening, part history. That's what makes it a really interesting read. But one plant that wasn't in your book that we were curious about, that if you used it and if you did use it, how you used it, was Fuki. Do you grow that?
I thought I did, but it seems to have died on me this winter again. It's not. It doesn't seem to be hardy enough. Although there are wild, you know, it comes again from Japan, Petasites japonica in Latin. I ate it a lot when I was in Japan. It can be quite an invasive species. So I've been a bit careful about for the times I have planted it. I've planted it in a big bucket rather so that it can't escape too much. At least initially, because although I wouldn't be scared of that if I had a garden where I was trying to produce as much food as possible, my garden is more of a collection of edible plants. So I need to try and keep things in the same place. And Fuki is... it's a delicious plant. I ate it a lot when I was in Japan, both in tempura and in other ways. Also the leaf stalks, which you see this again in all the supermarkets. There were fuki flower buds and leaf stalks for sale. It was obviously a very popular plant, and almost everywhere I travelled, I could see areas of fuki, particularly around where people were living. So it was obviously kind of wild gardening, if you like, because it was usually on the kind of away from the vegetable gardens, on the kind of a waste area. I would love to be able to grow it. I haven't given up, I'll be trying again.
So you think the best way to eat it is like fried or with like Asian stir fries or something?
Yeah. Stir fried or tempura or something like that. So certainly the leaf stalks seem to be used in kind of stir fry type dishes, Japanese style.
You'll be pleased to know we're both drinking dandelion tea right now, you know, to just... just as character actors, just getting in the mode for this interview. We're drinking dandelion tea.
Fantastic. Yeah.
But
My favorite plant.
I was just wondering, because, you know, everybody sees dandelion, like we taste it and it's bitter, but you know, obviously you cover the dandelion a lot in your book, but I was just wondering if you can just talk about dandelion a little bit and some of your favorite ways to prepare it.
Yeah, well, dandelion, it's a wild plant in my garden to start with. I could start by saying that, I grow something like 30 different dandelions. Now, there are literally tens of thousands of dandelion species in the world, you know, and there are many which are very similar, yellow flowering, but there are also white flowering species. I think you have one of those, don't you,
Yeah,
Aaron?
I have both, actually.
You do?
I have Albideum, I think is the white flowering species that
That's
I have.
That's right, it's a Japanese species, yeah.
And then the Pseudo-Rosum. Which is the kind of pinky one. And some others that I have a very limited number of that I'm still kind of experimenting with.
So you have that Lilacenum, don't you, from the Far East?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've actually found that one to be the least bitter of any dandelion I've tasted. Mm. However, it also seems to have a lot more pest pressure. So it gets aphids and stuff where all the other dandelions I've ever seen are just kind of indestructible.
Well, that makes sense, I suppose. Yeah. That's what the bitter substances are for.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are, you know, dandelions are just amazing. There's this huge diversity of leaf forms and different coloured, particularly for me, the pink flowered, what I call the pink flowered dandelion, which is Pseudo-Roseum, comes from Siberia originally. So it's extremely hardy. In fact, I discovered it originally being grown as an ornamental plant in gardens in the far north of Norway, far above the Arctic Circle. So I've been growing that one now for probably about 15 years, but there are a huge range of other ones. And when I think of dandelions, I mean, dandelions grow right the way across the Northern Hemisphere, in particularly in the temperate world, and right up into the Arctic. And native peoples have traditionally, indigenous peoples have used dandelions everywhere, more or less. So Native Americans, Japanese natives, all over. And so when we're eating dandelions, we're part of a kind of almost a global movement of dandelion eaters, dandelion tea drinkers, if you like. In my own garden, I certainly grow both the different species of dandelion from around the world, but also a number of cultivars of the common dandelion, which have been selected. Going back to another book from 1920, which is The Vegetable Garden, which is a French or an English translation of a French book. The Vegetable Garden came out in 1920, and it includes descriptions of something like, I think there's about six different dandelion cultivars which were cultivated in France at the time, and they're still cultivated in France and sold on markets in the springtime. And there was one particular variety of dandelion which was called the moth-leaved dandelion. There's an illustration in that book of this frilly-leaved dandelion which just looked really sexy. So and for many years I searched for that plant. When I gave talks, I had a slide in my talk presentation with a picture of the book from The Vegetable Garden from 1920, with a little caption saying, wanted dead or alive, the moss-leaved dandelion.
Perfect. preferably alive.
Because as far as I could see, it had gone, it was now extinct. I couldn't find it anywhere. And then after having shown this slide 100 times or more, I was giving a talk in Copenhagen in Denmark, and a guy put his hand up at the back. I know somebody that's growing it. And he was. And later that year, he sent me both seeds and a root, and I'm still growing that that dandelion in my garden today. It's doing extremely well. In addition to that, you ask about what I do with dandelion. Well, actually, you can, and this is a bit inspired by one of your best known foragers. What's his name now? Ewell Gibbons. Do you know him? Well, you know of him?
He was
probably the most popular foraging author in the 1960s in the US. He wrote a book, In Search of the Wild Asparagus, is what it's called.
Oh, yes. I have that book.
Stalking the Wild Asparagus, I think.
Stalking the Wild Asparagus, that's it.
Yeah. We had that book when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's a really cool book. And you should look that book up. He talks about making a complete dandelion meal. Okay? And I've kind of taken that, maybe a stage further, his description there. And, you can more or less use everything in a dandelion. So you could make a complete dandelion meal from the roots. It could be used as a root vegetable. The next thing to appear in the very early spring are what I call dandy chokes. Think of an artichoke, and the part of the artichoke you eat is underneath the flower, right? If you do think of the same thing with the dandelion, in the very early spring, the flowers appear at ground level. Now, if you dig down below the flower, you'll find that there's maybe up to an inch of greens, which are under the surface of the soil, which are white because they're blanched and there's no sunlight. That is the real gourmet part of the dandelion, the dandy choke. And then, of course, you can use the leaves. They can be used green and also blanched, most commonly blanched on markets because they're rather bitter tasting. But that's very, very specific on people with very different perception of bitterness. When I was a young man, I could not understand why anybody would consider eating a dandelion. For me, it was really, really bitter. Today, I enjoy the bitterness of dandelion, so I've changed. Whether it's part of aging or whether I've adapted to it, I'm not totally sure. But nobody ever ate raw dandelions just a salad without anything else. It was always mixed, like in a mixed salad, to dilute the bitterness. Or the old timers in the US, they would use bacon grease. Now, I'm a vegetarian, more or less, so I wouldn't use bacon grease, but the bacon grease has the same effect as the oil in the tempura. That it covers your tongue, and so the bitterness isn't so easily detected. So it becomes a milder tasting green. And the next thing on the dandelion, which is just before flowering, the flower stems extend, and you can use the flower stems to make what I call dandy noodles. So you can imagine if you harvest the flower stems just before the flowers open, and you just cook them very quickly in a little bit of water, and then have, for example, a little bit of butter on them afterwards, they really look like green noodles, and even kids love them. And then the flower buds could be stir-fried. Some people pickle them or ferment the flower buds. You can use the flowers. You can just scatter them over some of these multi-species salads, for example. And then you could make dandelion tea, which you're supping at the moment, I believe. Dandelion coffee. You can make dandelion wine. In fact, my dad, he makes dandelion wine every year, or even dandelion schnapps. And you could be drinking in tea through dandelion flower stalk straws. You should try that a bit later in the summer. And very soon after this fantastic dandelion meal that I've just described, you could actually cycle home on tires made of dandelion rubber. And I tell the story of that in my book, how I was the only supplier of a species of dandelion called the rubber dandelion. But I think I'll, it was back in, should I tell that story or to just let them read the book?
tell the story. I mean, we're all here. We're all gathered
around. Yeah, okay. Well, it was back in about 2002, and I was contacted by a researcher in Germany who was looking for this particular species of dandelion, which, you see, during the last World War, dandelions were cultivated because the roots, or the white substance you see in the roots when you cut them, is latex, which could be used to produce rubber. And during the last World War, there was a lot of cultivation of this rubber dandelion, both in Russia, in North America, and also in Germany, because the supplies of natural rubber from the tropical rubber trees had dried up. And about 15, 20 years ago, the rubber tree plantations in the tropics became infected by a fungal disease. And because there was no diversity, they're all genetically identical. If this fungal disease attacked a plantation, practically all the trees would die, and it was spreading. And they started talking about peak rubber, so not only peak oil, but peak rubber, because the supplies of the natural rubber from the tropical trees was declining. So scientists around the world got money to find the best alternative to this, and the best one that was known at the time was the rubber dandelion. There are other possibilities. There's a Scorzonera, for example, which has very high levels of latex in its roots, and a few other species as well. But the scientists, they couldn't get access to the seed of this particular rubber dandelion. Because I was a bit of a collector, I actually had managed to get hold of seed of this dandelion, Caraxacum coxsackis. It comes from West Asia. And I was growing it in my garden, and every year I made a seed list, which I put out on the internet in order to trade seed. And that particular year, I had it on my seed list. So I was contacted by this researcher in Germany, desperate to get hold of seed of this rubber dandelion so he could carry out his research. And not only that, I was contacted by another guy in North America who was even more desperate. He was talking about it being a matter of national security, which was quite cool. I felt as though I was in control of national security in the U.S. for a while.
I hope he didn't help the empire.
Yeah, I kind of regretted it, but he offered me loads of money, you know. I was relatively poor at the time, so I caved in, and I didn't think about the consequences. I'm sorry.
It's all right. Next time, send the rubber seeds to our enemies, please.
Yeah. Well, I sent it to the Canadians as well. And also to a Japanese scientist. So I was producing loads of seeds of this dandelion over quite a few years, and So that was my biggest, I didn't really sell seed, but when they were offering me a lot of money for producing as much as possible, I did send them. And then it took a long time, but I think it was 2 years ago, the big American car tire manufacturer, Continental, announced that they were testing the world's first car tire made out of natural rubber from the from this rubber dandelion. And I've seen pictures now of in quite a few countries of fields of basically yellow dandelions. It doesn't look that much different with this particular species that has a higher level of latex in its roots. But it was like quite an interesting story. And then I think it was the winter before last, the original guy that I sent seeds to in Germany wrote to me and said, oh, by the way, the seed that you sent us back in 2002 turned out not to be the real rubber dandelion. It was a kind of a closely related species, which grew in the same area as the rubber dandelion, but it actually wasn't the right thing. So I'm now kind of waiting for national security in the US to turn up at my doorstep, you know, when they demand their money back. But yeah. So so that was the rubber dandelion. So dandelions, in many ways, are becoming one of the most important plants. For me, I wouldn't be without dandelion. In fact, I use most dandelions in the winter because dandelions are basically a wild plant here, and they seed themselves on all around the garden and on beds. And I instead of weeding them out, I let them grow. And then I dig up the roots in the autumn. I bring them into my cellar, and the whole winter I'm forcing them. So I bring them up into, so I plant them in like a bucket with the roots in a bucket with soil. And then I bring the bucket up into a warmer room in the middle of the winter. And then I get a fresh flush of dandelion greens in the middle of the winter. So it really is one of the most important and probably one of the most healthiest plants as well that we could eat. And very useful and very easy because it's everywhere, you know. But I don't basically forage that much, I should say. I forage my own garden, but I very rarely go outside of the garden itself and find food.
Well, it sounds like you don't really need to.
I don't need to. I am pretty well 100% self-sufficient in greens and fruits within the relatively small area of my garden.
That's wonderful.
Cool. So,
that's a neat technique for forcing winter greens from perennial roots. What other species, if you could just mention a few real quick, do you do that with?
Oh, there are a lot that I've experimented with. I mean, winter vegetables is we could talk for hours about that. There are many different techniques for. I mean, I never go to the supermarket in the winter either, and I don't use. I don't have a greenhouse. I don't use any. I don't have a freezer. I don't actually ferment food to store it, or dry only fruit. I dry some fruit, but not vegetables. So I try and it's totally possible to have a diverse winter vegetables. Luckily, I have a cold basement under the house, which is about 4 degrees centigrade in the middle of the winter. Other things would be the chicories, for example. What else? I actually move most of like perennial kales. I'll move into the cellar in the winter because they're not totally hardy here, and they'll start shooting in the cellar. Or what else? I use horseradish shoots. I use a lot in the winter. Horseradish is a plant which spreads rather vigorously.
Oh, it sure does.
So every autumn I'm limiting it anyway, so I have an excess of roots. So I bring the roots into the cellar and force them in a similar way to what I described for dandelions. And they're blanched and milder tasting. So it's kind of like a mild wasabi taste.
Would arugula, is that something you can do with arugula roots as well?
Rucola, no. Well, rucola, you're thinking about the perennial rucola.
Yeah, I don't know. I've only grown one kind of arugula, and it just, like, Sylvet or whatever.
Okay, yeah. Or you could do it with Turkish rocket, for example. You could do it with anything, really. I do it with quite a few alliums. What else? Yeah, Scorzonera is another one. Chicories, I've mentioned chicories.
Scorzonera?
I bring inside Scorzonera.
Yeah. Scorzonera, what's the other name for that?
Black Salsify.
Right.
Scorzonera hispanica, which is another one of these. It's one of the plants, the 80 plants in my book. It really is most people think of it as or know it as a root vegetable. It's becoming available in supermarkets again now. Very long black roots. For me, it probably is one of the, in my garden, it's probably the second oldest perennial vegetable that I have. So I have plants which are over 35 years old, and I use everything apart from the roots. So it's a very long-lived perennial. Sorry?
Oh, I was just laughing that everyone else is eating the roots and you're eating everything else.
But actually, I grow it as a perennial. I save the seed. I sow the seed from the plant and harvest after 2 years as a root crop. Okay. The perennial plants I just let grow, and I use everything else on the plant apart from the roots, because the roots become very woody after a couple of years. So the young leaves in the springtime and the shoots, I remember the author Carol Depp called them Scorzonera lettuce. So it's a very good mild tasting basis for a spring salad. The flower shoots are surprisingly sweet tasting. So we take the flower shoots just before the buds open and just eat them as a salad or just as a snack. They're really delicious. And then you can use the flower buds in stir-fry dishes, for example. And again, the flowers can be used just like dandelion flowers on salads. And you can cut it, and it comes again, and very little trouble. I don't know of any pests, at least not here, on Scorzonera. Very long-lived, hardy, and, that's certainly one I'd have a lot of and do use a lot of.
That's amazing. I feel like we could talk to you for another 6 hours. I don't know what you got going on today, but... I can put another $20 in the Skype credit and I'm just kidding. So I feel like, we're at like an hour and a half and, or closer to whatever. And I need to.
Already? Wow.
Yeah. Time flies when you're talking plants. So we need to kind of wrap it up at pretty quick. But I was just.
Well, we could talk some more when I come over in the summer.
That would be awesome. We can do part two live at on Aaron's homestead. That would be amazing.
That sounds great.
I look forward to it. Yeah.
But thank you so much for writing this book. I mean, I feel like we barely scratched the surface of how amazing this book is. And I think that's good. If people like this conversation, they should absolutely go buy your book. But if people want to track your work and follow you, what's the best way for them to track you?
Well, they can either subscribe to my blog, edimentals.com, E-D-I-M-E-N-T-A-L-S, edible ornamentals, it stands for, .com, or you can find me on Facebook or Twitter. Yeah, it shouldn't be too difficult. Just Google me and Extreme Salad Man. Just Google Extreme Salad Man, you'll find me.
Oh, and you know what else? I also want to give a shout out to the Backyard Larder. That's actually the first blog that I'd come up on that put me in touch with your work, but I didn't really check it until Aaron did. I don't know if you know this blog.
Yeah, that's Alison Tyndale. She's in the UK. She's really cool. Yeah.
She's awesome, and I love her recipes. And I tried to get her on, and she didn't want to do it. She's like, you need to just talk to Steven because.
Did she?
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah.
Well, maybe she'll hear it and be like, "All right, I'll do it." Now, but cool. Thanks so much, and well, except for helping our government with better rubber, but other than that, you know, much love. Recommend a book. Do you have any book recommendations?
I
always like to ask everybody who comes on if they want to shout out a book or two that they feel like if people dig the interview, what they should read.
Well, I would. Well, my favorite author, apart from these, you know, I like these encyclopedic type books. I have, we've mentioned Cornucopia 2 and Stuart Avant's Edible Plants of the World, which is actually available online. You can probably find a link of that and put it up on your page. I also have a Japanese foraging book. Unfortunately, it's all in Japanese, so I have to use Google Translate scans, which is quite fun, but it doesn't always work. But as far as authors on edible plants, my favorite of all time is a guy called Samuel Thayer. You know him?
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, he's the reason that I'm coming over to the US. I was completely bowled over to get an invite to come and give a keynote address at the Midwest Wild Food Festival in Lancaster, Wisconsin, which is between the 27th and 29th of September. So he and his good lady, Melissa Price, have been putting on this gathering of some of the best foragers in North America for quite a few years now. I would certainly encourage you to look up Samuel Thayer. He's written three books on North American wild animals. Many of them could easily be domesticated. In fact, some of them are in my own book, Around the World in 80 Plants. But any of the three books that he's put out, so Wild Edible Plants, I can't remember what's the name, it's going over to my bookshelf here, Incredible Wild Edibles, The Forager's Harvest, and Nature's Garden. Absolutely brilliant books, really well researched, and when you read them, you'll know straight away that this guy has actually tried these plants. There are many foraging books where that isn't the case. Like beasts and guides and things like that. But this guy really knows his stuff. The other one in North America, of course, is John Callas in Oregon. He's written a very thorough, excellent book on wild edibles. They're actually all North American, that's just coincidental, I think. I'm sure I could think of a few more. There are some very good German books, but in German, unfortunately.
I think those are some great recommendations.
Yeah.
Yeah, and most of the listeners are English speakers, so it's, makes it easier for us. Well, hey, yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for, taking the time and being down to do this and, for just creating this wealth and body of work for lazy people like me to just copy off your notes and, get going on it.
Oh, it was a great pleasure.
Yeah, and it was nice to talk to you, and I look forward to your visit this fall.
Yes, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to seeing your place and seeing you in person for the first time. So we'll see you then. So I'm hoping to do a little tour around of, basically I'm going to Woodstock in Vermont and then hopefully coming over to you, Aaron. There was another Aaron up in, where was it, in Barr, Montpelier.
Yep.
And you had another couple of suggestions, so maybe it's going to be a little tour, giving a few talks and courses and things around your area.
Awesome. Well, we'll be there, and we'll be square.
Yeah. We'll be in touch anyway.
Awesome. Have a great day, man. Thanks again.
Bye, Steven.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, thanks for talking to me. Bye.